Kavita Ram Das, the head of the Global Fund for Women, said in 2001 that in an Indian village, all there is for a woman is to obey her husband and relatives, pound millet, and sing. If she moves to town, she can get a job, start a business, and get education for her children. An analysis in Bangladesh confirmed that the women who worked in the garment industry, as my grandparents did in 1930s Canada, enjoyed rising wages, later marriage, and fewer and better educated children. Over the course of a generation, slums, barrios, and favelas can morph into suburbs, and the working class can become middle class. To appreciate the long-term benefits of industrialization, one does not have to accept its cruelties. One can imagine an alternative history of the Industrial Revolution, in which modern sensibilities applied earlier, and the factories operated without children and with better working conditions for the adults. Today there are doubtless factories in the developing world that could offer as many jobs and still turn a profit while treating their workers more humanely. Pressure from trade negotiators and consumer protests has measurably improved working conditions in many places, and it is a natural progression as countries get richer and more integrated into the global community, as we will see in chapters 12 and 17, when we look at the history of working conditions in our own society. Progress consists not in accepting every change as part of an indivisible package, as if we had to make a yes or no decision on whether the Industrial Revolution or globalization is a good thing or bad thing, exactly as each is unfolded in every detail. Progress consists of unbundling the features of a social process as much as we can to maximize the human benefits while minimizing the harms. The last, and in many analyses the most important, contributor to the Great Convergence is science and technology. Life is getting cheaper in a good way. Thanks to advances in know-how, an hour of labor can buy more food, health, education, clothing, building materials, and small necessities and luxuries than it used to. Not only can people eat cheaper food and take cheaper medicines, but children can wear cheap plastic sandals instead of going barefoot, and adults can hang out together getting their hair done or watching a soccer game using cheap solar panels and appliances. As for good advice on health, farming, and business, it's better than cheap. It's free. Today, about half the adults in the world own a smartphone, and there are as many subscriptions as people. In parts of the world without roads, landlines, postal service, newspapers, or banks, mobile phones are more than a way to share gossip and cat photos. They are a major generator of wealth. They allow people to transfer money, order supplies, track the weather and markets, find day labor, get advice on health and farming practices, even obtain a primary education. An analysis by the economist Robert Jensen, subtitled "The Micro and Macro Economics of Information," showed how South Indian small fishermen increased their income and lowered the local price of fish by using their mobile phones at sea to find the market which offered the best price that day, sparing them from having to unload their perishable catch on fish-glutted towns while other towns went fishless. In this way, mobile phones are allowing hundreds of millions of small farmers and fishers to become the omniscient rational actors in the ideal, frictionless markets of economics textbooks. According to one estimate, every cell phone adds $3,000 to the annual GDP of a developing country. The beneficent power of knowledge has rewritten the rules of global development. Development experts differ on the wisdom of foreign aid. Some argue that it does more harm than good by enriching corrupt governments and competing with local commerce. Others cite recent numbers which suggest that intelligently allocated aid has in fact done tremendous good. But while they disagree on the effects of donated food and dollars, all agree that donated technology, medicines, electronics, crop varieties, and best practices in agriculture, business, and public health has been an unalloyed boon. As Jefferson noted, "He who receives an idea from me receives instruction without lessening mine." And for all the emphasis I've placed on GDP per capita, The value of knowledge has made that measure less relevant to what we really care about, quality of life. If I had squeezed a line for Africa into the lower right corner of figure 8-2, it would look unimpressive. The line would curve upward to be sure, but without the exponential blast-off of the lines for Europe and Asia. Charles Kenny emphasizes that the actual progress of Africa belies the shallow slope because health, longevity, and education are so much more affordable than they used to be. Though in general, people in richer countries live longer, a relationship called the Preston curve after the economist who discovered it, the whole curve is being pushed upward as everyone is living longer regardless of income. In the richest country 2 centuries ago, the Netherlands, life expectancy was just 40, and in no country was it above 45. Today, life expectancy in the poorest country in the world, the Central African Republic, is 54, and in no country is it below 45. Though it's easy to sneer at national income as a shallow and materialistic measure, it correlates with every indicator of human flourishing, as we will repeatedly see in the chapters to come. Most obviously, GDP per capita correlates with longevity, health, and nutrition. Less obviously, it correlates with higher ethical values like peace, freedom, human rights, and tolerance. Richer countries, on average, fight fewer wars with each other. Chapter 11. Are less likely to be riven by civil wars. Chapter 11. Are more likely to become and stay democratic. Chapter 14. And have greater respect for human rights. Chapter 14. On average, that is. Arab oil states are rich but repressive. The citizens of richer countries have greater respect for emancipative or liberal values such as women's equality, free speech, gay rights, participatory democracy, and protection of the environment. Chapters 10 and 15. Not surprisingly, as countries get richer, they get happier. Chapter 18. More surprisingly, as countries get richer, they get smarter. Chapter 16. In explaining this Somalia to Sweden continuum, with poor, violent, repressive, unhappy countries at one end and rich, peaceful, liberal, happy ones at the other, correlation is not causation. And other factors like education, geography, history, and culture may play roles. But when the quants try to tease them apart, they find that economic development does seem to be a major mover of human welfare. In an old academic joke, a dean is presiding over a faculty meeting when a genie appears and offers him one of 3 wishes, money, fame, or wisdom. The dean replies, "That's easy. I'm a scholar. I've devoted my life to understanding. Of course I'll take wisdom." The genie waves his hand and vanishes in a puff of smoke. The smoke clears to reveal the dean with his head in his hands, lost in thought. A minute elapses. 10 minutes. 15. Finally, a professor calls out, "Well? Well?" The dean mutters, "I should have taken the money." Chapter 9. Inequality. But is it all going to the rich? That's a natural question to ask in developed countries in the second decade of the 21st century, when economic inequality has become an obsession. Pope Francis called it the root of social evil. Barack Obama, the defining challenge of our time. Between 2009 and 2016, the proportion of articles in the New York Times containing the word inequality soared tenfold, reaching 1 in 73. The new conventional wisdom is that the richest 1% have skimmed off all the economic growth of recent decades, and everyone else is treading water or slowly sinking. If so, the explosion of wealth documented in the previous chapter would no longer be worth celebrating, since it would have ceased contributing to overall human welfare. Economic inequality has long been a signature issue of the left, and it rose in prominence after the Great Recession began in 2007. It ignited the Occupy Wall Street movement in 2011 and the presidential candidacy of the self-described socialist Bernie Sanders in 2016, who proclaimed that a nation will not survive morally or economically when so few have so much, while so many have so little. But in that year, the revolution devoured its children and propelled the candidacy of Donald Trump, who claimed that the United States had become a third-world country, and blamed the declining fortunes of the working class not on Wall Street and the 1%, but on immigration and foreign trade. The left and right ends of the political spectrum, incensed by economic inequality for their different reasons, curled around to meet each other, and their shared cynicism about the modern economy helped elect the most radical American president in recent times. Has rising inequality really immiserated the majority of citizens? Economic inequality undoubtedly has increased in most Western countries since its low point around 1980, particularly in the United States and other English-speaking countries, and especially in the contrast between the very richest and everyone else. Economic inequality is usually measured by the Gini coefficient, a number that can vary between zero, when everyone has the same as everyone else, and one, when one person has everything and everyone else has nothing. Gini values generally range from 0.25 for the most egalitarian income distributions, such as in Scandinavia after taxes and benefits, to 0.7 for a highly unequal distribution, such as the one in South Africa. In the United States, the Gini index for market income before taxes and benefits rose from 0.44 in 1984 to 0.51 in 2012. Inequality can also be measured by the proportion of total income that is earned by a given fraction, quantile, of the population. In the United States, the share of income going to the richest 1% grew from 8% in 1980 to 18% in 2015, while the share going to the richest 0.1% grew from 2% to 8%. There's no question that some of the phenomena falling under the inequality rubric, there are many, are serious and must be addressed, if only to diffuse the destructive agendas they have incited, such as abandoning market economies, technological progress, and foreign trade. Inequality is devilishly complicated to analyze. In a population of 1 million, there are 999,999 ways in which they can be unequal, and the subject has filled many books. I need a chapter on the topic because so many people have been swept up in the dystopian rhetoric and see inequality as a sign that modernity has failed to improve the human condition. As we will see, this is wrong, and for many reasons. The starting point for understanding inequality in the context of human progress is to recognize that income inequality is not a fundamental component of well-being. It is not like health, prosperity, knowledge, safety, peace, and the other areas of progress I examine in these chapters. The reason is captured in an old joke from the Soviet Union. Igor and Boris are dirt-poor peasants, barely scratching enough crops from their small plots of land to feed their families. The only difference between them is that Boris owns a scrawny goat. One day a fairy appears to Igor and grants him a wish. Igor says, "I wish that Boris's goat should die." The point of the joke, of course, is that the two peasants have become more equal, but that neither is better off, aside from Igor's indulging his spiteful envy. The point is made with greater nuance by the philosopher Harry Frankfurt in his 2015 book, On Inequality. Frankfurt argues that inequality itself is not morally objectionable. What is objectionable is poverty. If a person lives a long, healthy, pleasurable, and stimulating life, then how much money the Joneses earn, how big their house is, and how many cars they drive are morally irrelevant. Frankfurt writes, "From the point of view of morality, it is not important everyone should have the same. What is morally important is that each should have enough." Indeed, a narrow focus on economic inequality can be destructive if it distracts us into killing Boris's goat instead of figuring out how Igor can get one. The confusion of inequality with poverty comes straight out of the lump fallacy, the mindset in which wealth is a finite resource like an antelope carcass, which has to be divvied up in zero-sum fashion, so that if some people end up with more, others must have less. As we just saw, wealth is not like that. Since the Industrial Revolution, it has expanded exponentially. That means that when the rich get richer, the poor can get richer too. Even experts repeat the lump fallacy, presumably out of rhetorical zeal rather than conceptual confusion. Thomas Piketty, whose 2014 bestseller Capital in the 21st Century became a talisman in the uproar over inequality, wrote, "The poorer half of the population are as poor today as they were in the past, with barely 5% of total wealth in 2010, just as in 1910. But total wealth today is vastly greater than it was in 1910, so if the poorer half own the same proportion, they are far richer, not as poor." A more damaging consequence of the lump fallacy is the belief that if some people get richer, they must have stolen more than their share from everyone else. A famous illustration by the philosopher Robert Nozick, updated for the 21st century, shows why this is wrong. Among the world's billionaires is J.K. Rowling, author of the Harry Potter novels, which have sold more than 400 million copies and have been adapted into a series of films seen by a similar number of people. Suppose that a billion people have handed over $10 each for the pleasure of a Harry Potter paperback or movie ticket, with a tenth of the proceeds going to Rowling. She has become a billionaire, increasing inequality, but she has made people better off, not worse off, which is not to say that every rich person has made people better off. This doesn't mean that Rowling's wealth is just desserts for her effort or skill, or a reward for the literacy and happiness she added to the world. No committee ever judged that she deserved to be that rich. Her wealth arose as a byproduct of the voluntary decisions of billions of book buyers and moviegoers. To be sure, there may be reasons to worry about inequality itself, not just poverty. Perhaps most people are like Igor and their happiness is determined by how they compare with their fellow citizens rather than how well off they are in absolute terms. When the rich get too rich, everyone else feels poor. So inequality lowers well-being even if everyone gets richer. This is an old idea in social psychology, variously called the theory of social comparison, reference groups, status anxiety, or relative deprivation. But the idea must be kept in perspective. Imagine Seema, an illiterate woman in a poor country who is village-bound, has lost half her children to disease and will die at 50, as do most of the people she knows. Now imagine Sally, an educated person in a rich country who has visited several cities and national parks, has seen her children grow up, and will live to 80, but is stuck in the lower middle class. It's conceivable that Sally, demoralized by the conspicuous wealth she will never attain, is not particularly happy, and she might even be unhappier than Seema, who is grateful for small mercies. Yet it would be mad to suppose that Sally is not better off, and positively depraved to conclude that one may as well not try to improve Seema's life because it might improve her neighbors' lives even more and leave her no happier. In any case, the thought experiment is moot, because in real life, Sally almost certainly is happier. Contrary to an earlier belief that people are so mindful of their richer compatriots that they keep resetting their internal happiness meter to the baseline, no matter how well they are doing, we will see in Chapter 18 that richer people and people in richer countries are, on average, happier than poorer people and people in poorer countries. But even if people are happier when they and their countries get richer, might they become more miserable if others around them are still richer than they are? That is, as economic inequality increases. In their well-known book, The Spirit Level, the epidemiologists Richard Wilkinson and Kate Pickett claim that countries with greater income inequality also have higher rates of homicide, imprisonment, teen pregnancy, infant mortality, physical and mental illness, social distrust, obesity, and substance abuse. The economic inequality causes the ills, they argue. Unequal societies make people feel that they are pitted in a winner-take-all competition for dominance, and the stress makes them sick and self-destructive. The spirit-level theory has been called the left's new theory of everything, and it is as problematic as any other theory that leaps from a tangle of correlations to a single-cause explanation. For one thing, it's not obvious that people are whipped into competitive anxiety by the existence of J.K. Rowling and Sergey Brin, as opposed to their own local rivals for professional, romantic, and social success. Worse, economically egalitarian countries like Sweden and France differ from lopsided countries like Brazil and South Africa in many ways other than their income distribution. The egalitarian countries are, among other things, richer, better educated, better governed, and more culturally homogeneous. So a raw correlation between inequality and happiness, or any other social good, may show only that there are many reasons why it's better to live in Denmark than in Uganda. Wilkinson and Pickett's sample was restricted to developed countries, but even within that sample, the correlations are evanescent, coming and going with choices about which countries to include. Wealthy but unequal countries, such as Singapore and Hong Kong, are often socially healthier than poorer but more equal countries, such as those of ex-communist Eastern Europe. Most damagingly, the sociologists Jonathan Kelly and Mariah Evans have snipped the causal link joining inequality to happiness in a study of 200,000 people in 68 societies over 3 decades. We will examine how happiness and life satisfaction are measured in Chapter 18. Kelly and Evans held constant the major factors that are known to affect happiness, including GDP per capita, age, sex, education, marital status, and religious attendance, and found that the theory that inequality causes unhappiness comes to shipwreck on the rock of the facts. In developing countries, inequality is not dispiriting, but hardening. People in the more unequal societies are happier. The authors suggest that whatever envy, status anxiety, or relative deprivation people may feel in poor, unequal countries is swamped by hope. Inequality is seen as a harbinger of opportunity, a sign that education and other routes to upward mobility might pay off for them and their children. Among developed countries, other than formerly communist ones, inequality made no difference one way or another. In formerly communist countries, the effects were also equivocal. Inequality hurt the aging generation that grew up under communism, but helped or made no difference to the younger generations. The fickle effects of inequality on well-being bring up another common confusion in these discussions, the conflation of inequality with unfairness. Many studies in psychology have shown that people, including young children, prefer windfalls to be split evenly among participants, even if everyone ends up with less overall. That led some psychologists to posit a syndrome called inequity aversion, an apparent desire to spread the wealth. But in their recent article, Why People Prefer Unequal Societies, the psychologists Christina Starmans, Mark Sheskin, and Paul Bloom took another look at the studies and found that people prefer unequal distributions, both among fellow participants in the lab and among citizens in their country, as long as they sense that the allocation is fair, that the bonuses go to harder workers, more generous helpers, or even the lucky winners of an impartial lottery. There is no evidence so far, the authors conclude, that children or adults possess any general aversion to inequality. People are content with economic inequality as long as they feel that the country is meritocratic, and they get angry when they feel it isn't. Narratives about the causes of inequality loom larger in people's minds than the existence of inequality. That creates an opening for politicians to rouse the rabble by singling out cheaters who take more than their fair share. Welfare queens, immigrants, foreign countries, bankers, or the rich, sometimes identified with ethnic minorities. In addition to effects on individual psychology, Inequality has been linked to several kinds of society-wide dysfunction, including economic stagnation, financial instability, intergenerational immobility, and political influence peddling. These harms must be taken seriously, but here too the leap from correlation to causation has been contested. Either way, I suspect that it's less effective to aim at the Gini index as a deeply buried root cause of many social ills than to zero in on solutions to each problem. Investment in research and infrastructure to escape economic stagnation, regulation of the finance sector to reduce instability, broader access to education and job training to facilitate economic mobility, electoral transparency and finance reform to eliminate illicit influence, and so on. The influence of money on politics is particularly pernicious because it can distort every government policy. But it's not the same issue as income inequality. After all, in the absence of electoral reform, the richest donors can get the ear of politicians, whether they earn 2% of national income or 8% of it. Economic inequality, then, is not itself a dimension of human well-being, and it should not be confused with unfairness or with poverty. Let's now turn from the moral significance of inequality to the question of why it has changed over time. The simplest narrative of the history of inequality is that it comes with modernity. We must have begun in a state of original equality, because when there is no wealth, everyone has equal shares of nothing. And then, when wealth is created, some can have more of it than others. Inequality in this story started at zero, and as wealth increased over time, inequality grew with it. But the story is not quite right. Hunter-gatherers are, by all appearances, highly egalitarian, a fact that inspired Marx and Engels' theory of primitive communism. But ethnographers point out that the image of forager egalitarianism is misleading. For one thing, the hunter-gatherer bands that are still around for us to study are not representative of an ancestral way of life, because they have been pushed into marginal lands and lead nomadic lives that make the accumulation of wealth impossible, if for no other reason than that it would be a nuisance to carry around. But sedentary hunter-gatherers, such as the natives of the Pacific Northwest, which is flush with salmon, berries, and fur-bearing animals, were florid inegalitarians and developed a hereditary nobility who kept slaves, hoarded luxuries, and flaunted their wealth in gaudy potlatches. Also, while nomadic hunter-gatherers share meat, since hunting is largely a matter of luck, and sharing a windfall ensures everyone against days in which they come home empty-handed, they are less likely to share plant foods, since gathering is a matter of effort, and indiscriminate sharing would allow free riding. Some degree of inequality is universal across societies, as is an awareness of inequality. A recent survey of inequality in the forms of wealth that are possible for hunter-gatherers, houses, boats, and hunting and foraging returns, found that they were far from a state of primitive communism. The Gini's averaged 0.33, close to the value for disposable income in the United States in 2012. What happens when a society starts to generate substantial wealth? An increase in absolute inequality, the difference between the richest and poorest, is almost a mathematical necessity. In the absence of an income distribution authority that parcels out identical shares, some people are bound to take greater advantage of the new opportunities than others, whether by luck, skill, or effort, and they will reap disproportionate rewards. An increase in relative inequality, measured by the Gini or income shares, is not mathematically necessary, but it is highly likely. According to a famous conjecture by the economist Simon Kuznets, as countries get richer, they should get less equal, because some people leave farming for higher-paying lines of work while the rest stay in rural squalor. But eventually a rising tide lifts all the boats. As more of the population gets swept into the modern economy, inequality should decline, tracing out an inverted U. This hypothetical arc of inequality over time is called the Kuznets curve. In the preceding chapter, we saw hints of a Kuznets curve for inequality between countries. As the Industrial Revolution gathered steam, European countries made a great escape from universal poverty, leaving the other countries behind. As Deaton observes, a better world makes for a world of differences. Escapes make for inequality. Then, as globalization proceeded and wealth-generating know-how spread, poor countries started catching up in a great convergence. We saw hints of a drop in global inequality in the blast-off of GDP in Asian countries, figure 8-2, in the morphing of the world income distribution from snail to two-humped camel to one-humped dromedary, figure 8-3, and in the plunging proportion, figure 8-4, and number, figure 8-5, of people living in extreme poverty. To confirm that these gains really constitute a decline in inequality, that poor countries are getting richer faster than the rich countries are getting richer, we need a single measure that combines them, an international Gini, which treats each country like a person. Figure 9-1 shows that the international Gini rose from a low of 0.16 in 1820, when all countries were poor, to a high of 0.56 in 1970, when some were rich, and then, as Kuznets predicted, it plateaued and began to droop in the 1980s. But an international Gini is a bit misleading. Because it counts an improvement in the living standards of a billion Chinese as equivalent to an improvement in the standards of, say, 4 million Panamanians. Figure 9-1 also shows an international Gini calculated by the economist Branko Milanović, in which every country counts in proportion to its population, making the human impact of the drop in inequality more apparent. Still, an international Gini treats all the Chinese as if they earned the same amount, all the Americans as if they earned the American average, and so on, and as a result it underestimates inequality across the human race. A global Gini in which every person counts the same, regardless of country, is harder to calculate because it requires mixing the incomes from disparate countries into a single bowl. But two estimates are shown in Figure 9-2. The lines float at different heights because they were calibrated in dollars adjusted for purchasing parity in different years, but their slopes trace out a kind of Kuznets curve. After the Industrial Revolution, global inequality rose steadily until around 1980, then started to fall. The international and global Gini curves show that despite the anxiety about rising inequality within Western countries, inequality in the world is declining. That's a circuitous way to state the progress, though. What's significant about the decline in inequality is that it's a decline in poverty. The version of inequality that has generated the recent alarm is the inequality within developed countries like the United States and the United Kingdom. The long view of these countries is shown in Figure 9-3. Until recently, both countries traveled the Kuznets arc. Inequality rose during the Industrial Revolution and then began to fall, first gradually in the late 19th century, then steeply in the middle decades of the 20th. But then, starting around 1980, inequality bounced into a decidedly un-Kuznetsian rise. Let's examine each segment in turn. The rise and fall in inequality in the 19th century reflects Kuznets's expanding economy, which gradually pulls more people into urban, skilled, and thus higher-paying occupations. But the 20th century plunge, which has been called the Great Leveling or the Great Compression, had more sudden causes. The plunge overlaps the two world wars, and that is no coincidence. Major wars often level the income distribution. Wars destroy wealth-generating capital, inflate away the assets of creditors, and induce the rich to put up with higher taxes, which the government redistributes into the paychecks of soldiers and munition workers, in turn increasing the demand for labor in the rest of the economy. Wars are just one kind of catastrophe that can generate equality by the logic of Igor and Boris. The historian Walter Scheidel identifies four horsemen of leveling: mass mobilization warfare, transformative revolution, state collapse, and lethal pandemics. In addition to obliterating wealth, and in the communist revolutions, the people who owned it, the Four Horsemen reduce inequality by killing large numbers of workers, driving up the wages of those who survive. Scheidel concludes, "All of us who prize greater economic equality would do well to remember that, with the rarest of exceptions, it was only ever brought forth in sorrow. Be careful what you wish for." Scheidel's warning applies to the long run of history. But modernity has brought a more benign way to reduce inequality. As we have seen, a market economy is the best poverty reduction program we know of for an entire country. It is ill-equipped, however, to provide for individuals within that country who have nothing to exchange, the young, the old, the sick, the unlucky, and others whose skills and labor are not valuable enough to others for them to earn a decent living in return. Another way of putting it is that a market economy maximizes the average, but we also care about the variance and the range. As the circle of sympathy in a country expands to encompass the poor, and as people want to insure themselves should they ever become poor, they increasingly allocate a portion of their pooled resources, that is, government funds, to alleviating that poverty. Those resources have to come from somewhere. They may come from a corporate or sales tax or a sovereign wealth fund, but in most countries they largely come from a graduated income tax, in which richer citizens pay at a higher rate because they don't feel the loss as sharply. The net result is redistribution. But that is something of a misnomer, because the goal is to raise the bottom, not lower the top, even if in practice the top is lowered. Those who condemn modern capitalist societies for callousness toward the poor are probably unaware of how little the pre-capitalist societies of the past spent on poor relief. It's not just that they had less to spend in absolute terms, they spent a smaller proportion of their wealth. A much smaller proportion. From the Renaissance through the early 20th century, European countries spent an average of 1.5% of their GDP on poor relief, education, and other social transfers. In many countries and periods, they spent nothing at all. In another example of progress, sometimes called the egalitarian revolution, modern societies now devote a substantial chunk of their wealth to health, education, pensions, and income support. Figure 9-4 shows that social spending took off in the middle decades of the 20th century, in the United States with the New Deal in the 1930s, in other developed countries with the rise of the welfare state after World War II. Social spending now takes up a median of 22% of their GDP. The explosion in social spending has redefined the mission of government, from warring and policing to also nurturing. Governments underwent this transformation for several reasons. Social spending inoculates citizens against the appeal of communism and fascism. Some of the benefits, like universal education and public health, are public goods that accrue to everyone, not just the direct beneficiaries. Many of the programs indemnify citizens against misfortunes for which they can't or won't insure themselves, hence the euphemism social safety net. And assistance to the needy assuages the modern conscience, which cannot bear the thought of the little match girl freezing to death, Jean Valjean imprisoned for stealing bread to save his starving sister, or the Jodes burying Grandpa by the side of Route 66. Since there is no point in everyone sending money to the government and getting it right back, minus the bureaucracy's cut, social spending is designed to help people who have less money, with the bill footed by people who have more money. This is the principle known as redistribution, the welfare state, social democracy, or socialism, misleadingly, because free market capitalism is compatible with any amount of social spending. Whether or not the social spending is designed to reduce inequality, that is one of its effects, and the rise in social expenditures from the 1930s through the 1970s explains part of the decline in the Gini. Social spending demonstrates an uncanny aspect of progress that we'll encounter again in subsequent chapters. Though I am skittish about any notion of historical inevitability, cosmic forces, or mystical arcs of justice, some kinds of social change really do seem to be carried along by an inexorable tectonic force. As they proceed, certain factions oppose them hammer and tongs, but resistance turns out to be futile. Social spending is an example. The United States is famously resistant to anything smacking of redistribution. Yet it allocates 19% of its GDP to social services, and despite the best efforts of conservatives and libertarians, the spending has continued to grow. The most recent expansions are a prescription drug benefit introduced by George W. Bush and the eponymous health insurance plan known as Obamacare, introduced by his successor. Indeed, social spending in the United States is even higher than it appears because many Americans are forced to pay for health, retirement, and disability benefits through their employers rather than the government. When this privately administered social spending is added to the public portion, the United States vaults from 24th into second place among the 35 OECD countries, just behind France. For all their protestations against big government and high taxes, people like social spending. Social Security has been called the third rail of American politics because if politicians touch it, they die. According to legend, an irate constituent at a town hall meeting warned his representative, "Keep your government hands off my Medicare," referring to the government health insurance program for seniors. No sooner did Obamacare pass than the Republican Party made it a sacred cause to repeal it. But each of their assaults on it, after gaining control of the presidency in 2017, was beaten back by angry citizens at town hall meetings and legislators afraid of their ire. In Canada, the top two national pastimes, after hockey, are complaining about their healthcare system and boasting about their healthcare system. Developing countries today, like developed countries a century ago, stint on social spending. Indonesia, for example, spends 2% of its GDP, India 2.5%, and China 7%. But as they get richer, they become more munificent, a phenomenon called Wagner's Law. Between 1985 and 2012, Mexico quintupled its proportion of social spending, and Brazil's now stands at 16%. Wagner's Law appears to be not a cautionary tale about overweening government and bureaucratic bloat, but a manifestation of progress. The economist Leandro Prados de la Escosura found a strong correlation between the percentage of GDP that an OECD country allocated to social transfers as it developed between 1880 and 2000 and its score on a composite measure of prosperity, health, and education. And tellingly, the number of libertarian paradises in the world, developed countries without substantial social spending, is zero. The correlation between social spending and social well-being holds only up to a point. The curve levels off starting at around 25% and may even drop off at higher proportions. Social spending, like everything, has downsides. As with all insurance, it can create a moral hazard in which the insured slack off or take foolish risks, counting on the insurer to bail them out if they fail. And since the premiums have to cover the payouts if the actuaries get the numbers wrong or the numbers change so that more money is taken out than put in, the system can collapse. In reality, social spending is never exactly like insurance, but is a combination of insurance, investment, and charity. Its success thus depends on the degree to which the citizens of a country sense they are part of one community, and that fellow feeling can be strained when the beneficiaries are disproportionately immigrants or ethnic minorities. These tensions are inherent to social spending and will always be politically contentious. Though there is no correct amount, all developed states have decided that the benefits of social transfers outweigh the costs and have settled on moderately large amounts, cushioned by their massive wealth. Let's complete our tour of the history of inequality by turning to the final segment in Figure 9-3. The rise of inequality in wealthy nations that began around 1980. This is the development that inspired the claim that life has gotten worse for everyone but the richest. The rebound defies the Kuznets curve, in which inequality was supposed to have settled into a low equilibrium. Many explanations have been proffered for this surprise. Wartime restrictions on economic competition may have been sticky, outlasting World War II, but they finally dissipated, freeing the rich to get richer from their investment income and opening up an arena of dynamic economic competition with winner-take-all payoffs. The ideological shift associated with Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher slowed the movement toward greater social spending, financed by taxes on the rich, while eroding social norms against extravagant salaries and conspicuous wealth. As more people stayed single or got divorced, and at the same time more power couples pooled two fat paychecks, the variance in income from household to household was bound to increase, even if the paychecks had stayed the same. A second industrial revolution, driven by electronic technologies, replayed the Kuznets' rise by creating a demand for highly skilled professionals who pulled away from the less educated at the same time that the jobs requiring less education were eliminated by automation. Globalization allowed workers in China, India, and elsewhere to underbid their American competitors in a worldwide labor market, and the domestic companies that failed to take advantage of these offshoring opportunities were outcompeted on price. At the same time, the intellectual output of the most successful analysts, entrepreneurs, investors, and creators was increasingly available to a gargantuan worldwide market. The Pontiac worker is laid off, while J.K. Rowling becomes a billionaire. Milanovic has combined the two inequality trends of the past 30 years, declining inequality worldwide, increasing inequality within rich countries, into a single graph which pleasingly takes the shape of an elephant, Figure 9-5. This growth incidence curve sorts the world's population into 20 numerical bins or quantiles, from poorest to richest, and plots how much each bin gained or lost in real income per capita between 1988, just before the fall of the Berlin Wall, and 2008, just before the Great Recession. The cliché about globalization is that it creates winners and losers, and the elephant curve displays them as peaks and valleys. It reveals that the winners include most of humanity. The elephant's bulk, its body and head, which includes about 7/10 of the world's population, consists of the emerging global middle class, mainly in Asia. Over this period, they saw cumulative gains of 40-60% in their real incomes. The nostrils at the tip of the trunk consist of the world's richest 1%, who also saw their incomes soar. The rest of the trunk tip, which includes the next 4% down, didn't do badly either. Where the bend of the trunk hovers over the floor around the 85th percentile, we see globalization's losers, the lower middle classes of the rich world, who gained less than 10%. These are the focus of the new concern about inequality, the hollowed-out middle class, the Trump supporters, the people globalization left behind. I couldn't resist plotting the most recognizable elephant in Milanovic's herd because it serves as a vivid mnemonic for the effects of globalization, and it rounds out a nice menagerie with the camel and dromedary in Figure 8-3. But the curve makes the world look more unequal than it really is, for two reasons. One is that the financial crisis of 2008, which postdated the graph, had a strangely equalizing effect on the world. The Great Recession, Milanovic points out, was really a recession in North Atlantic countries. The incomes of the world's richest 1% were trimmed, but the incomes of workers elsewhere soared. In China, they doubled. 3 years after the crisis, we still see an elephant, but it has lowered the tip of its trunk while arching its back twice as high. The other elephant distorter is a conceptual point that bedevils many discussions of inequality. Whom are we talking about when we say the bottom fifth or the top 1%? Most income distributions use what economists call anonymous data. It tracks statistical ranges, not actual people. Suppose I told you that the age of the median American declined from 30 in 1950 to 28 in 1970. If your first thought is, "Wow, how did that guy get 2 years younger?" then you have confused the two. The median is a rank, not a person. Readers commit the same fallacy when they read that the top 1% in 2008 had incomes that were 50% higher than the top 1% in 1988, and conclude that a bunch of rich people got half again richer. People move in and out of income brackets, shuffling the order, so we're not necessarily talking about the same individuals. The same is true for the bottom fifth and every other statistical bin. Non-anonymous or longitudinal data, which track people over time, are unavailable in most countries. So Milanovic did the next best thing and tracked individual quantiles in particular countries so that, say, poor Indians in 1988 were no longer being compared with poor Ghanaians in 2008. He still got an elephantoid, but with a much higher tail and haunches, because the poorer classes of so many countries rose out of extreme poverty. The pattern remains. Globalization helped the lower and middle classes of poor countries and the upper class of rich countries, much more than it helped the lower middle class of rich countries, but the differences are less extreme. Now that we have run through the history of inequality and seen the forces that push it around, we can evaluate the claim that the growing inequality of the past three decades means that the world is getting worse, that only the rich have prospered, while everyone else is stagnating or suffering. The rich certainly have prospered more than anyone else, perhaps more than they should have, but the claim about everyone else is not accurate for a number of reasons. Most obviously, it's false for the world as a whole. The majority of the human race has become much better off. The two-humped camel has become a one-humped dromedary. The elephant has a body the size of, well, an elephant. Extreme poverty has plummeted and may disappear, and both international and global inequality coefficients are in decline. Now, it's true that the world's poor have gotten richer in part at the expense of the American lower middle class, and if I were an American politician, I would not publicly say that the trade-off was worth it. But as citizens of the world considering humanity as a whole, we have to say that the trade-off is worth it. But even in the lower and lower middle classes of rich countries, moderate income gains are not the same as a decline in living standards. Today's discussions of inequality often compare the present era unfavorably with the golden age of well-paying, dignified, blue-collar jobs that have been made obsolete by automation and globalization. This idyllic image is belied by contemporary depictions of the harshness of working-class life in that era, both in journalistic exposés, such as Michael Harrington's 1962 The Other America, and in realistic films, such as On the Waterfront, Blue Collar, Coal Miner's Daughter, and Norma Rae. The historian Stephanie Kuntz, a debunker of 1950s nostalgia, puts some numbers into the depictions. A full 25% of Americans, 40 to 50 million people, were poor in the mid-1950s, and in the absence of food stamps and housing programs, this poverty was searing. Even at the end of the 1950s, a third of American children were poor. 60% of Americans over 65 had incomes below $1,000 in 1958, considerably below the $3,000 to $10,000 level considered to represent middle-class status. A majority of elders also lacked medical insurance. Only half the population had savings in 1959. One quarter of the population had no liquid assets at all. Even when we consider only native-born white families, one-third could not get by on the income of the household head. How do we reconcile the obvious improvements in living standards in recent decades with the conventional wisdom of economic stagnation? Economists point to four ways in which inequality statistics can paint a misleading picture of the way people live their lives, each depending on a distinction we have examined. The first is the difference between relative and absolute prosperity. Just as not all children can be above average, it's not a sign of stagnation if the proportion of income earned by the bottom fifth does not increase over time. What's relevant to well-being is how much people earn, not how high they rank. A recent study by the economist Stephen Rose divided the American population into classes using fixed milestones rather than quantiles. Poor was defined as an income of $0 to $30,000 in 2014 dollars for a family of three. Lower middle class as $30,000 to $50,000, and so on. The study found that in absolute terms, Americans have been moving on up. Between 1979 and 2014, the percentage of poor Americans dropped from 24 to 20. The percentage in the lower middle class dropped from 24 to 17, and the percentage in the middle class shrank from 32 to 30. Where did they go? Many ended up in the upper middle class, $100,000 to $350,000, which grew from 13 to 30% of the population, and in the upper class, which grew from 0.1% to 2%. The middle class is being hollowed out in part because so many Americans are becoming affluent. Inequality undoubtedly increased. The rich got richer faster than the poor and middle class got richer, but everyone, on average, got richer. The second confusion is the one between anonymous and longitudinal data. If, say, the bottom fifth of the American population gained no ground in 20 years, it does not mean that Joe the plumber got the same paycheck in 1988 that he did in 2008, or one that's a bit higher owing to cost of living increases. People earn more as they get older and gain experience or switch from a lower-paying job to a higher-paying one. So Joe may have moved from the bottom fifth into, say, the middle fifth, while a younger man or woman or an immigrant took his place at the bottom. The turnover is by no means small. A recent study using longitudinal data showed that half of Americans will find themselves among the top tenth of income earners for at least 1 year of their working lives, and that one in nine will find themselves in the top 1%, though most don't stay there for long. This may be one of the reasons that economic opinions are subject to the optimism gap, the "I'm okay, they're not" bias. A majority of Americans believe that the standard of living of the middle class has declined in recent years, but that their own standard of living has improved. A third reason that rising inequality has not made the lower classes worse off is that low incomes have been mitigated by social transfers. For all its individualist ideology, the United States has a lot of redistribution. The income tax is still graduated, and low incomes are buffered by a hidden welfare state that includes unemployment insurance, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, temporary assistance for needy families, food stamps, and the earned income tax credit, the kind of negative income tax in which the government boosts the income of low earners. Put them together and America becomes far less unequal. In 2013, the Gini Index for American market income, before taxes and transfers, was a high 0.53. For disposable income, after taxes and transfers, it was a moderate 0.38. The United States has not gone as far as countries like Germany and Finland, which start off with a similar market income distribution, but level it more aggressively, pushing their Ginis down into the high 0.2s and sidestepping most of the post-1980s inequality rise. Whether or not the generous European welfare state is sustainable over the long run and transplantable to the United States, some kind of welfare state may be found in all developed countries, and it reduces inequality even when it is hidden. These transfers have not just reduced income inequality, in itself a dubious accomplishment, but boosted the incomes of the non-rich, a real one. An analysis by the economist Gary Burtless has shown that Between 1979 and 2010, the disposable incomes of the lowest four income quintiles grew by 49, 37, 36, and 45% respectively. And that was before the long delay